Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Fadel Kaboob. Fadel is professor of economics at Denison University in Ohio. He's a research associate at the Levy Institute of Bard College, New York, and the Center for Full Employment. Gee, what's full employment? We haven't seen that around the U.S. in an awful long time. We had it in World War II for sure, but we sure don't have it now. Anyway, the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability in Missouri and the International Policy Institute in Ontario, Canada. Fadel teaches and he focuses heavily on macroeconomic theory and policy, monetary theory and policy, and economic development, especially job creation and social justice. And we could sure use a lot of both today. That is for certain. We want to focus on the economic side of things. And Fadel and I exchanged a couple of emails before the program suggesting we also tie it in with events in the Middle East. Libya certainly is in the spotlight now. I thought a good way to begin there and then bring in the economic side. And I'll let my expert guest, Fadel Kaboob, do it. Fadel, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, it's terrific having you on. What are your thoughts about what's going on in the Middle East? And then we'll bring it over to the economic side.
Let's start from the beginning, the kind of domino effect that started in Tunisia in late December 2010, and then talk a little bit about the sequence of events and the differences, because clearly Libya is not Tunisia, Tunisia is not Egypt. There are some significant differences. But I want to talk about this idea that the revolution in the Middle East in a way has started in Tunisia and the revolution is ended, which is a myth. I mean, for me, the way I look at this, the Tunisian revolution can at least be viewed in kind of four phases. And this is without going all the way back to colonialism. I'm talking about recent history. The first phase is what I call the neoliberal phase. Which started in the mid-1980s with the introduction of structural adjustment policies, World Bank and IMF sponsored privatization of state-owned enterprises, the removal of subsidies for basic food, and clearly turning the Tunisian economy into your typical free market, free trade type of society. And that led to significant increases in income inequality. It was a significant attack on the middle class in Tunisia, which was very strong in the 1950s and 60s, post-independence. Now, that led to a few labor movements here and there, a few kind of leftist protests that were immediately crushed by the government. And to understand the significance of this domino effect and why it started in Tunisia and the kind of message that it sent to Libya and the people in Egypt and the people in Yemen, we have to think a little bit about the personality of the former president, Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, in Tunisia, his background, and the nature of the police state in Tunisia. This is something that many observers have not noticed very much. Tunisia had the highest police-to-population ratio in the world. This is very significant. So when people in Egypt and Libya and Yemen see the one of the most aggressive police states in the world being toppled within a matter of 23 days, with essentially peaceful protests, with no Abraham tanks, no F-16s, no military coup. That sends a very strong message to the people in the region, saying this can be done, this is doable. And notice the similarities and the messages of the protesters in Tunisia and Libya and Bahrain and Yemen and Egypt. Even some of the signs were the exact same signs were used. That famous "Game Over" sign. You see it in Tunis, you see it in Tahrir Square, you see it in Libya. So that's the significance of, you know, Tunisia being the starting point, kind of sparking this whole movement.
Can I throw in a comment, Fadel?
Yes, please.
I've written about pretty much to one extent or another about all of the I don't use the word revolution.
Yeah.
Libya may, in fact, be a well, I don't even call Libya a revolution. I call it an insurrection.
Yeah.
It is very, very definitely different from all the other countries. For certain, there are no fly zones on the other countries. There are no U.S., France, Britain bombings, et cetera, and so on. We know that. And I always wonder, when a long-standing despot falls, because the ones that America supports strongly in the West, they seem to manage to survive through thick and thin. I have no doubt that Washington wanted Mubarak out. He outlived his usefulness some years back, and they found a legitimate popular uprising to use as a pretext to get rid of him, but the regime is still in place. I honestly don't know, but I wonder if the same applied to Ben Ali in Tunisia. Do you think there's a possibility that he also outlived his usefulness and the West and Washington wanted to get rid of him but keep the regime in power?
I think that that's not true in the case of Tunisia. In the case of Egypt, clearly the regime is still the same. It's still a military regime, and it's not clear if a true radical revolution has happened in terms of changing the regime. It's the person that, you know, left office, and we're not clear about what's going to happen in Egypt because it's more complicated, and I can comment on that. But in the case of Tunisia, it really caught everybody by surprise. I mean, Tunisia's relation kind of with the West is primarily with France, so the U.S. influence was not as strong as U.S. influence in Egypt or Libya or Saudi Arabia or Bahrain. France was caught by surprise. I mean, until the last day of President Ben Ali's tenure in Tunis, in January 13, 2011, the French government and the French Minister of Foreign Affairs were still offering support, offering help to send, you know, riot police support and tear gas until the very last day. And so they didn't expect this to happen. They didn't expect a truly popular grassroots uprising to withstand massive kind of riot police violence. Although there was a little bit of there's a small detail. I mean, it's kind of a leaderless revolution, but there was some helpful kind of leadership in the background. If you remember what happened in Tunis, 5 or 6 days before Ben Ali left the country, he fired the top military official because he refused to intervene and support the riot police. He refused to fire on the people. So he was fired. Then 5 days later, he comes back with the support of the army and negotiates Ben Ali's departure. And I think that was critical. But then that same General Ben Ammar, he went back into the background. He's not interested in political leadership or you know, any role in the government. He's in a way, he's kind of the unknown hero of the revolution because he did not want to intervene against the people, and he was not interested in leading, you know, taking over presidency or taking over the government.
But as you say, the old leader, the old despot is gone,
yeah.
But the regime is still there, and they can replace like a chessboard.
Yeah.
It's the same chessboard. The pieces can change on the board, but the chessboard stays the same. So you've got the same regime running things, and the Tunisians absolutely a popular uprising. They want real democratic change, and they want jobs.
Exactly.
And they want what everybody else in the region wants, because because there's terrific unemployment, a great poverty, a great deprivation, and people are sick and tired of this. So the spark was lit, and it just moves across the whole region, including in Egypt. It's the same in Egypt as far as the regime. You got rid of Mubarak, but you got a military junta replacing him. I don't think there has ever been an instance in history anywhere where a military junta decided that they would get rid of despotism and become Democrats.
Exactly.
I mean, that is really an oxymoron. So I don't see that happening. But there's still people pressure on the regime to get to do things. So they have this referendum to put some amendments in place. But as you say, you know, I mean, it'll take a good while for everything to play out, and who knows what will come out on the other end. But I truly believe, Fadel, that for people to win enough to at least be reasonably happy, a long struggle lies ahead.
Oh, absolutely. And this is why I'm more optimistic about the case of Tunisia than Egypt, because on January 15th, the youth movement and the protesters that ousted Ben Ali did not go home, because they know that it's an entire regime that has to change. And they kept pushing for every single member of the ruling party to be removed from the interim government. They kept pushing to dismantle the secret police. They kept pushing to dismantle and ban the former ruling party. Not only that, but they kept pushing for even the corporate sector and the private sector to remove the corrupt members who were, in a sense, cooperating with the former regime. They were part of the corrupt system. They were part of the plutocracy. And that's really the significance of the strength of the youth movement in Tunisia, because it didn't go home right after the departure of the president. So that's why I'm hopeful, because the military is less involved, clearly, than in the case of Egypt. And it's the lawyers, it's the doctors, it's the unemployed, it's the educated youth, it's the women's movements groups, it's everyone that's constantly being involved since January 15th, and it didn't stop. And it's not easy to recreate a new economic and democratic and political structure, and everybody knows that. But nobody's willing to give it up and leave it up to politicians and leave it up to, you know, members of the former regime or the military or the police to reorganize the government.
Well,
so there's hope there, and it's not an easy task. It's very labor-intensive.
There is hope. I absolutely agree with that. And I must say, since this really erupted en masse across the region, it's been truly breathtaking. Fadel, I wish that some of that spark would be ignited right here in America, because the levels of poverty and unemployment and so on are just crushing so many millions of people. But except for maybe some complaining and moaning and this and that, there is no activism on the streets, people rallying for their own rights. And unless they do that, they don't have a chance of getting them. Things will get worse, not better. I'd like you to address the whole economic situation, but before you do, switch over to Libya. What is your take on what's happening in Libya?
It's truly a tragedy. I mean, Gaddafi's tenure in Libya for over 40 years now, with, you know, on and off support from the West, but mostly support from the West. When you look at the number of people that were massacred over the last few days and by Gaddafi's forces, we have to think a little bit critically about, you know, the situation, and not rush to quick conclusions about what's been happening in the last 2 months or 3 months. Let's put this in historical context. There were people who were being killed and tortured and oppressed in Libya for decades. Nobody paid attention, right? Now we're paying attention. And I'm not saying we shouldn't be paying attention to the massacres, but let's put it in a bigger context. Why did the British government, why did the French government, why did the American government, and all the European governments since 2003 re-invite Gaddafi back into their palaces and their parliaments to, you know, renounce terrorism, supposedly, and to go back to having, you know, formal diplomatic relations with these governments after he paid for, you know, the families of the Lockerbie massacre
even though he had nothing to do with Lockerbie.
Yes, exactly. Well, what happened right after 2003? Contracts started being signed between the government of Libya and, you know, military industrial complex in France and Britain and the U.S. Those are the same weapons that he's using right now to massacre his own people. Gaddafi was invited into the French Parliament to give a speech on human rights, on women's rights, and you see all those, you know, parliamentarians nodding their heads. These are the people who should be brought back, you know, today and ask those tough questions. So the rush to a no-fly zone and a military intervention, even Secretary Gates said it, you know, a few days ago, right before the intervention. He said, let me make this clear. He said, a no-fly zone means starting with an attack on Libya. And tell me, when was the last time you've seen a no-fly zone or any kind of military intervention in the Middle East or anywhere else in the world that ended within a matter of days? We remember the shock and awe doctrine of the Bush administration that this is going to be over within a matter of days. How many years are we in Iraq now?
It's still going on. And, of course, Afghanistan, yeah. America's longest ever war. You're absolutely right. I've written about five or six articles on Libya. And a no-fly zone is an act of war. And the Security Council, the unfolding of events, the external unfolding of events there, Fadel, the Security Council, by adopting a no-fly zone, the abstentions to me were the same as voting aye. Every single member of the Security Council knew that by voting for a no-fly zone, they were voting for an act of war. So the gross hypocrisy for any of them to say, well, we just meant protecting the civilians. The hell they did. I don't know what they had in mind, whether they gave a damn about the civilians, but they knew they were voting for an act of war. If you're going to fly your planes over a country that you have potential hostilities with, then you need to take out the command and control, the ground defenses and so on. You don't want those surface-to-air missiles knocking down your aircraft that are illegally over your airspace. Yep. So they declared war on Libya, and there's no such a thing as a short war, as you said. This will be protracted. Very likely, thousands of people will be affected, either killed or maimed or injured. There'll be an awful lot of destruction, because every time we wage a war, Fadel, we love destruction. What better way to give contracts to our corporate friends to rebuild once we take over the place?
Exactly.
I could go on and on and on and on.
Of course, yeah.
One more thing. By passing this resolution, Resolution 1973, the Security Council violated its own charter, Article 51. They violated their own charter by doing this. And are these people that stupid that they didn't know that? I wrote about it.
Yeah. The Security Council, the whole UN structure is not a democratic system, as you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Even if you have, you know, consensus amongst the 15 members of the Security Council, you have to think about how did those countries come to that consensus. You can't, you know, forget the heavy influence of the American government, of the British government, of the French government. And these are, you know, the top three, you know, military, you know, forces now intervening in the region, and in Libya in particular.
I call it bribing and bullying, Fadel.
Exactly. Because, I mean, when you're dealing with international relations type of issues and peace and security type of issues, when countries vote on a particular issue, they're voting in the broader context of their relation to the U.S. regarding trade agreements, regarding immigration, regarding democracy and freedom. So there's a whole variety of things that they have to consider, because you don't want to vote against the U.S. interest or the French interest on a matter of principle, so to speak, in terms of Resolution 1973, and then face two decades of economic sanctions, right? I mean, you have to take that into content.
Oh, absolutely. Even China and Russia, by abstaining, they went against their own interests. Yeah. Unless it was a sweet bribe thrown in for both of them, who knows?
Yeah, exactly. So it's, as I said, it's a tragedy that we rushed to military intervention. None of the other traditional options were considered, and it's a double standard. You know, why Libya? Why not a no-fly zone over the Palestinian territories when Israel is bombarding Palestine?
You pegged the title of an article that I'm still working on for tomorrow, and I call it "Target Israel." Not Libya.
Yeah.
Indeed. I mean, the place that needs a no-fly zone is over Gaza.
Yeah.
But I mean, even the West Bank, you don't get jets firing missiles into the West Bank, but you get ground incursions that kill people. In a week's period, they'll make multiple incursions into civilian neighborhoods, arrest civilians, arrest children, throw them in a lockup someplace. Torture them. What kind of a regime does this and gets away with it decade after decade after decade after decade, and nothing is done? I mean, that's where sanctions are needed. That's where no-fly zones are needed.
If you remember, when all these events started in Tunis and Egypt and other parts of the Middle East, I mean, who were the only governments that were still supporting Ben Ali and Mubarak and the other despots of the region? It was the American government. If you remember that interview with Joe Biden, when he was asked, is Mubarak a dictator? His answer was, no, I don't think so. He's been pro-U.S., working for peace and all that. And the other governments that were still supporting Mubarak was the Israeli government and the so-called Palestinian Authority and the West Bank, that was crushing protests in support of the youth movement in Egypt and Tunisia. So it's the incursions within the West Bank are also supported by not just by the American government, but also by the corrupt regime that's been a pro-U.S., pro-Israeli regime in the West Bank.
Oh, absolutely. The Abbas government, literally a quisling government. And, of course, it's been mentioned many times in this program, the 2006 elections, yep. Hamas won. Hamas is the legitimate government. Abbas is a president, but his term
expired.
And
supposedly the Abbas government is supposedly the model for democratic statehood that the U.S. is supporting.
Oh, it's pretty sad. Fidel, you tell me if you want to stick in the Middle East or just talk about economic issues overall, because I'm very much interested in your views about the global economy and the U.S. economy. And I'm not an economist, but my thinking is that it's a mirage to think that, the recession is over and all is well. Just relax and enjoy it. It'll be nice, sustained growth, et cetera, and so on. Should we get into that issue?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Let's
get into the mirage
of
the end of the recession.
Oh, yeah. We've got about 8 minutes left. I'll let you cover the economy in 8 minutes.
Well, that's very good. The U.S. economy and the global economy in 8 minutes. Well, some of this has something to do with the domestic economic issues in the U.S. Let's not forget the U.S. is the largest economy in the world. It's heavily dependent on consumer spending, on consumerism. Earlier in the program, you mentioned the middle class in the U.S. and unemployment and all the economic problems that we're facing. To put it again in historical context, think about the effective federal tax rate in the U.S., say in the early 1950s, mid-1950s. That's 86% for the top 1% households, 86%. Now we're looking at about 30%. So you have a consistent economic policy, federal government economic policy, to reduce the tax burden on the wealthiest Americans since the 1960s, and more aggressively, obviously, in the 1980s. At the same time, you see that for the middle class, the effective tax rate is going from 5% in the early 1950s to about 13, 14% right now. So this is, again, essentially an attack on the middle class, and it's a regressive redistribution policy. Now, again, let's remember that consumer spending is very important, which means the middle class and low-income groups are very important for economic growth. So what you see is You know, how do you kind of convince the middle class and or allow the middle class and the working class to continue spending and drive economic growth in the U.S. when the tax burden is shifted heavily against them? Well, the answer is indebtedness, consumer credit. And you start seeing household debt-to-income ratio rising exponentially since the 1980s. And this is where Wall Street plays a significant role in terms of financial innovation, finding new ways to allow consumers to spend beyond their limits, to spend beyond their means. And you get to the peak of, you know, 2007, where you see the debt-to-income ratio for American households reaching 140%, which means if you have a family making $100,000, their total debt level is $140,000. Now, that's unsustainable. That's the highest level in human history.
What is it now?
Right now, it came down a little bit, and it's around 125%.
Still pretty high.
Still very high. The highest in the history of the universe. Again, no other country, you know, faces this.
In other words,
now,
for the first time in years, people began saving.
Yes, and for the first time in decades. So when you break that down by income group for U.S. households, so the average is 140% at the peak. When you look at the poorest 20% of U.S. households, their debt-to-income ratio got to 220%. Now, what this does is when you create essentially a heavily indebted middle class and low-income, you know, class, working class, when you create that in the U.S. economy, that kind of answers your question when you're saying, why aren't people protesting? Why aren't people rebelling? Well, you're creating an obedient working class, and at some point, even Alan Greenspan essentially praised the situation, saying, this is actually great. The more people have, you know, to worry about their mortgage debt and their monthly payments, the more pressure you keep on, you know, rising wages, which will bring down inflation, which is good for the Fed, right? So this is not a kind of an accident. To me, the way I see it, this is by design. This is consistent economic policy, you know, Republican, Democratic administrations, all the same. So when you have a working class group that's heavily indebted, worrying about, you know, making their, you know, monthly payments, you know, paycheck to paycheck, and then you add to this the media propaganda about how great the free market is, how great the stock market is, and how we should all worry about inflation and worry about the stock market, you know, day to day. When are you going to find time to find critical news sources about your own economic situation as a member of the working class? When are you going to have time to walk down to City Hall and organize a labor movement or organize some kind of popular protest against economic policies? And look at the situation in Wisconsin. Did it spread all over the country? Barely. A little bit in Ohio, a little bit in states where, you know, the working class is threatened. But again, it didn't create that massive national movement. You kind of see it in kind of isolated pockets, kind of trying to put down fires here in Wisconsin, here in Ohio, a little bit in New York. And then it ends, and then we go back to the same cycle.
And even Wisconsin, Fidel, it's mostly ebbed, and the union bosses literally were working against their own rank and file. The only thing they were concerned about is not losing the collective bargaining right to collect member dues, because that's how they stuff their own pockets and keep their lucrative six-figure salaries, et cetera, and so on. And my feeling was that the only way to really get what you're fighting for is you don't quit. And the one weapon that the working people have that they can't exercise if they decide en masse to do it is a general strike. I mean, just shut the whole bloody state down and keep it down until basic rights are brought back. And they're not asking for the moon. They just don't want to be fleeced. They don't want government working to hurt them, not help them. But you're right. There has not been a lot of momentum around the country. My feeling is I'm thinking mostly about the people who've lost their jobs, can't find one, and the millions who've lost their homes, and they're not worried about mortgage payments. And I don't know why they're worried about their debt. They just ought to walk away from it. And, of course, a lot of people are there. They're clearing bankruptcy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one interesting point maybe to tie the Middle East to Wisconsin is the missed opportunity for President Obama, because he's really missed the opportunity to be on the right side of the democratic peaceful movement in the Middle East, and he's missed the opportunity to be on the side of the people in the U.S. You know, why not take advantage of that huge momentum in Wisconsin and Ohio and side with the people instead of siding with Wall Street?
Oh, indeed so. I have written volumes on that topic as well, and I didn't expect much from Obama when he came into office, but he certainly has exceeded my worst fears, and I shudder thinking what's coming in the next 2 years, Fidel. This time, if you and I were on air 2 years from today, I just can't imagine that things won't be worse than they are now. My great fear is how much worse will they get?
Yeah.
A real serious issue. Fidel, I thank you so much for coming on. This was
thank
a much
you.
Too fast 30 minutes. As you say, you cannot cover these big issues, even in a half hour. Imagine the major media trying to do it in sound bites.
Oh, it's terrible. It's terrible. I can't even stand the mainstream media.
I mean, it's awful. And, of course, the sound bites aren't real information. They're propaganda.
Yeah.
Fidel, many, many thanks for coming on. I do hope we can do this again.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And join us this weekend, of course, at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And there will be lots more good information about the things that everybody needs to know. Do join us.